Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the, well, most difficult front lines of that war is in a place called Sudan. It's in the heart of Africa. It is a dark place indeed at the moment because of a Sharia supremacist government in the capital of Sudan, Khartoum, that has been using its military power and other means to attack and genocidally murder people in regions of its own country and now the country that has become separated from it, South Sudan, for decades. Much of it done at the hands of its dictator, Omar al-Bashir. A man who has just made a film about one of the focal points of Bashir's genocidal mayhem at the moment in the Nuba Mountains is with us, I'm very pleased to say. His name is Kenneth Carlson. He is an independent filmmaker who runs Carlson Films. To his credit, he has made documentaries, award-winning documentaries at that, one of which is Go Tigers, another Wild Bill Hollywood maverick. And now, a very important new documentary about the Nuba Mountain people and a remarkable doctor who's been caring for them for years, entitled The Heart of Nuba. I'm very pleased to say welcome, Kenneth Carlson, to Washington as well as to our program. I know you're doing a screening of your film this evening. I'm looking forward to being there and very anxious to talk with you about what you've done. So thanks for joining us here at Secure Freedom Radio.
Frank, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be back here in Washington, D.C. I lived here for almost seven years, so it feels like I'm coming home.
Well, you escaped the swamp for the wilds of California. Heaven help you. Out of the frying pan into the fire. Well, tell us a little bit about the film and what you were trying to accomplish in making it.
You know, this is a very personal film for me. Dr. Tom Katina, the only surgeon within hundreds of miles and the only doctor for about a million people in the Nuba Mountains of Sudan, not to be confused with South Sudan. He and I went to Brown University together. Not only were we classmates, but we were football players together, graduated the same class. And not only were we football players, we were on the same defensive line. So we had each other's backs literally back in the 1980s, and we continue to do so today. So it's really about a story. It's a story, you know, at its core about good friends and about a bond that was created. But of course, you throw Tom into one of the nastiest conflicts in the world today, in a conflict that is largely forgotten. And you've got yourself a recipe for what I would say a good drama. But primarily, it's very personal for me. And that's how I got involved in the story, because Tom is living a selfless, courageous life and what he would consider work of our Lord and Savior and our Maker, Jesus Christ. So it's pretty impressive what he's doing.
And that's a pretty important part of the story, as I understand it. Certainly the story in the context of the Nuba Mountain people, these are predominantly, as I understand it, Christians who are being relentlessly attacked through bombings and ground action and other means, as I gather, for the fact that they are Christians, something that this Sharia supremacist in Khartoum, Bashir, apparently finds a particular justification for this kind of mayhem. Is that right?
That is going on. But I want to make sure that everybody understands this is Africa in sub-Sahara, and there is, in fact, Muslims living there as well. There are Catholics, there's Protestants, there's animists, there's people of traditional African beliefs. They are all, it's a melting pot. And Omar Hassan al-Bashir has taken issue with them because they have rebelled against him and have said, we believe this is our land. And of course, Bashir wants it for, because it's resource rich. So there is a mixture of religions there, and he considers the Muslims that are there, that they're impure. They're not like he is up north. So there is definitely a religious facet to this, but primarily I would say that it is resource driven. You know, there's such a thing called the resource curse, and they have it up north in Khartoum. It's a dustbin. Not a lot grows there, and it is not mineral rich. You go down into the fertile lands of the Nuba Mountains in the Blue Nile District, and things change quickly. So he wants that land, and it's but it's very typical in this part of the world for this kind of cleansing to take place as well. So, you know, and it's also Africa. It's very tribal in that part of the world as well.
There's a lot going on, no question about it, but it certainly happens that a lot of people who are Christians are being persecuted viciously there, among others. And this is, of course, a part of the larger problem that is confronting the world at the moment, it seems to me, with, by some estimates, 215 million Christians being heavily persecuted. So to the extent you're calling attention to that piece of the story as well, this is an important film. Tell us a little bit more about your friend Tom and his heroic work. I gather he's been at it for some 11 years, is that right? In this, essentially, single-handedly, it sounds like, trying to tend to huge numbers of people. It's almost unimaginable.
It is unimaginable. I'm so proud of my friend. He has brought not only care to this part of the world, as we've just discussed, it's a war zone. So he's got a MASH unit going out there. Not only has he brought care into this part of the world, but really hope. And that's what's incredible, that people wake up in the morning, know that they have an option. We like to call Tom the last line of defense. People know that he is ultimately there. And keep in mind, there's the last time they had a census there was never. So we're not quite sure how many are there, anywhere from 750,000 to 1.25 million. And how, you know, many can actually reach Tom at the hospital in the Mother Mercy, we're unsure. But I'll tell you this much, there's 435 beds. Each one is occupied, most with two people. And in the pediatric ward, there's three per bed. So this man gets up every morning at 5:30 without an alarm clock after being woken up the entire night to treat patients. He gets up and marches to the chapel and spends a half an hour settling himself, praying, focusing, and then a half an hour with a chaplain and some congregants and singing and reading scripture, focusing. Then he goes right into breakfast, which consists of a little bit of coffee, rice, beans, or sorghum, which is all they have there. And then he marches into the hospital to start rounds around 7:15, and he's there the entire day. And will not leave. And he operates two to three times a week, two to three days, as in the entire day, just operating. Then he goes into a clinic for about 2 hours, and he's done around 6:30, 7 o'clock on a early day.
I think actually we're at the end of our time, so let me just ask you very quickly, how can our audience find out more about it?
We premiered it in New York City. It's been in Los Angeles for 2 weeks, and it is now spreading out across the United States. Go to theheartofnuba.com and find out where it's playing in a city near you.
Thank you very much, Kenneth Carlson. Next up, we'll speak with Congressman Steve King about, well, what's happening to Christians, among many other issues, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It is a delight to say we are joined by one of my favorite members of the United States House of Representatives. He is Congressman Steve King. He represents with great distinction the people of the 4th District of Iowa. He is, among other things, the chairman of an important, well, caucus, I guess you'd call it, in the United States Congress. It is the Conservative Opportunity Society, with a very interesting lineage, founded originally by Newt Gingrich. He serves on the Agriculture Committee, the House Small Business Committee, and perhaps most importantly, the House Judiciary Committee. We're delighted to have him with us always. Congressman, thanks so much for taking some time. Welcome back.
Well, thanks a lot for having me on, Frank. And I sure appreciate your friendship and the leadership you provide to this country.
Well, bless you. Thank you, sir. It's a mutual admiration society. Let me ask you, as a member of the Judiciary Committee, I know you're following very closely developments in connection with the Department of Justice and its responsiveness, or more accurately, its lack of responsiveness to the Congress on a number of inquiries that you all have been engaged in, either in the Judiciary Committee, the Intelligence Committee, or I think the Oversight Committee. This has got to a point where some of the members of the House Freedom Caucus, of which I believe you are an important member, have started brooding the idea that the guy who seems to be responsible for a lot of the obstruction, among other interesting and very problematic things, is the Deputy Attorney General of the United States, Rod Rosenstein. He's rather vigorously lashed out at folks like you, and I wanted to invite your thoughts as to what's going on here and what should the public make of it all.
Well, Frank, first I'd say that I'm not a formal member of the Freedom Caucus, but they are my brethren. And I work with them. Closely, and their initiative on this is their initiative, not as much mine. But I see the path that they're following, and I see the need for people to step up and start to make a case on this. I've had gone through the path of respect for Rod Rosenstein to the point now where I stack up the things that he has done and what that all means. And for example, he's the one that reported or that appointed Robert Mueller to become the special counsel. And that was facilitated, I believe, with coordination between James Comey and likely Robert Mueller and Rod Rosenstein. Then he's the acting attorney general. They're on everything that has to do with Russia because Jeff Sessions has recused himself from Russia. I've questioned him under oath before the Judiciary Committee at least once, perhaps more, and watched his demeanor. And I remember how his demeanor when he was asked the question, did the FBI pay for the dossier? And we didn't get a straight answer out of that. But I watched his body language on that, and I thought, uh-oh, there is something there that we need to know. Furthermore, he has signed at least one and likely more of the FISA warrants and to spy on Americans that were done so based on the dossier, and they've been renewed by Rosenstein. So,
without disclosing the provenance of that to the judges, right?
Yes, that does describe it. The judges didn't know the basis upon which they were relying, and it wasn't a reliable basis in the first place. In fact, it wasn't even a legal basis in the first place. And so when we get to this point, when I've asked this question, I might have been of him, but a number of the people that have testified before the Judiciary Committee on this topic, what about the fruit of the poisonous tree? If you have FISA warrants to spy on Americans that are illegally attained by, let's say, false information or failure of disclosure before the FISA judge, then that fruit of the poisonous tree under the legal standard is not admissible in court. And it could be that the entire Mueller investigation is based upon the fruit of the poisonous tree. So this mess they're dragging us in, this is a very, very complex strategy emanating from the resistance, from the resist movement. And I believe the trail leads all the way back to Barack Obama.
Yeah. And we'll be talking more about this shortly with Diana West about, you know, the extent to which instruments of the United States government are effectively being used to wage war against the president of the United States. It's absolutely astonishing. And I hope that your colleagues will be pursuing this effort to hold Rod Rosenstein, among others, accountable. Congressman Steve King.
Before we shift gears on this, I'd like to say from my position, and that is that I want to go a little bit slower than they do because I want to see the IG report, the Inspector General report for the Department of Justice come out. And I anticipate that's going to happen fairly soon. And I'm going to guess within the next 2 to 3 weeks, it will be this month. I'm fairly confident. And then we should then take a look at that report, see how Attorney General Jeff Sessions acts and reacts, see if there's new investigations that are started, that maybe reinvestigations started, and let's see if there's any indictments that'll be asked for by the Inspector General. At that point, then, I'll be ready to make a decision on whether I want to join in the impeachment effort with Rod Rosenstein.
Let me ask you about another issue that I know is on your mind. We've been talking about it a lot on this program and will in the course of this program today as well. This effort by President Trump to denuclearize the North Korean regime of Kim Jong-un, your thoughts about that, and particularly I'd be interested in any implications that it may have, his diplomacy there, with respect to this lying regime that is joined at the hip with the North Koreans in Iran.
Well, I think it's an interesting hypothesis that I've developed here, and it's not based upon anything said directly to me by anyone in the West Wing or the president. But when South Korea came to the White House to plead with the president, lift the tariff off of the steel that they're exporting to the United States. South Korea is the third largest exporter of steel to the United States. The 25% tariff that has been laid out by the president to essentially the world, with now the offered exceptions of Canada and Mexico, they were third largest, China the largest. And while they're there at the White House, I'm presuming this actually, to ask the president, give us the same break you gave Canada and Mexico, they had in their pocket the invitation to meet with Kim Jong-un. And so nobody expected the president to accept that invitation, but he did. And when they offered it, he said, I'll take you up on that, and walked over into the press room in the White House, stuck his head in the door where he hadn't ever spoken before, and said, I'm going to meet with Kim Jong-un, and the South Koreans will be issuing a press release on that in a few hours. Well, typical to President Trump, he scooped the South Koreans on that. And when something happens and the president makes a decision, then whether or not I think it's the right decision, I have to shift over to how do we get the best possible result out of this? And so I'm looking at this thing from the optimistic side. What if he's right? What if this meeting that may well be this month and may well be right on the 38th parallel in a very symbolic way, what if it results in actually the denuclearization of North Korea? And I think that dropping the mother of all bombs on the mountain in Afghanistan sent a message to Kim Jong-un. We don't have to go nuclear to end your nuclear program or to end you, Kim. And I think that's part of in the mind of Kim Jong-un. So if this actually happens and it's verifiable, that and one of the signals of that would be if the border starts to open up and allow people to travel back and forth to a degree between North and South Korea, I think that those kind of transitions, the denuclearization that we could verify in North Korea, sends a message to Iran. Now, President Trump will turn his attention to you. You've been violating the Iranian trade, the nuclear agreement. And President Trump has said all along, I'm going to tear it up. He has the obligation to reauthorize it and along the way in different sequences along the way.
The waiver of sanctions, at least. Yeah.
Yes. And so it may be that President Trump could pivot from a potential North Korean success to turn the focus on Iran, and that would change the dynamics over there in the Middle East in a significant way. And so I'm looking to that, thinking there is a long game here that could turn out to be a really excellent result. But of course, we know that the world being what it is, there are pitfalls all along the way. And yet, this is such an improbable change of events here in North Korea, we can't discount the potential that it could be completely successful.
Let me finally ask you about the Kurds. You have focused, you've spent time in Kurdish areas. I know in Iraq, you've, I think, been as troubled as I have been by what appears to be the abandonment of folks who have been in that part of the world, apart, of course, from Israel, about as reliable allies as we've had. The Turks are now actually attacking them in Syria, and I think would like to do so elsewhere as well. What should American policy be, as you see it, vis-a-vis the Kurds, Congressman Steve King?
Well, first I would say that there was a referendum on the Iraqi Kurds last fall, perhaps September, that 92% of the Kurds that went to the polls that day said they'd like to be an independent nation state, a sovereign nation state. And shortly after that, then Secretary of State Tillerson announced that it was an illegitimate referendum. I think that was a mistake on our foreign policy, and I've said so to the Kurds, and I've done this in what would now be international media, and that we should have acknowledged the result of that referendum and opened the door, at least, if not recognized the Kurdistan as an independent nation state. Had we done that, they would be an independent nation state today, in my opinion, and they would be our allies for the next 100 years or more. That might have been enough to intimidate the Turks to keep them from attacking Kurds in northern Syria. I've said to the Kurds, and I've been over there to meet with them several times, with the Barzanis, and two generations of them would be how I guess I'd describe that. And I say to them, I would like to see you be an independent nation state, but you know, look to the east, look to the west if you choose, but don't look to the north into Turkey. Don't even act like you're any at all interested about influencing anything across the border into Turkey, because Erdogan is unhinged and he's unpredictable, but he's also very reactionary. And I think that's what's going on now. I think Erdogan sees in Turkey that sees the threat of an independent nation state occurred.
We'll talk with you again soon, sir. Thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Lawrence Sellin is up next on China and more straight ahead.
More with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined once again, as we have the privilege of being from time to time, by Colonel Dr. Lawrence Sellin. He is both a colonel in the United States Army Reserves, now retired after 29 years of service to our country, including in combat in some pretty hellacious places, including Afghanistan and Iraq, as I recall. Also, he is a PhD. Physiologist by training, among other things, and an extraordinarily good resource for us on matters involving Asia, especially a subject in which he is deeply knowledgeable. He is the author of Restoring the Republic, Arguments for a Second American Revolution, and you can often find his writings at the Daily Caller, one of which caught my eye, as a matter of fact. We'll be talking with him about it now. Dr. Sellin, welcome back. Good to have you, sir.
Oh, thank you, Frank.
The one that I am referring to, I think, is just out yesterday, if I'm not mistaken, about the long game that you say China is playing in Korea and that we ignore in the pursuit of some sort of deal with Kim Jong-un at our peril. Talk about that.
Yes, that's right, Frank. China and North Korea are connected, but they're operating at different levels. Ever since before the Korean War, in fact, the North Koreans have only had basically two objectives. That is the survival of the regime and then to reunite the Korean Peninsula under North Korean dictatorship. And they see things like nuclear weapons and missiles as tools to reach those goals. Now, China sees North Korea as a way to distract the United States so it pursues larger aims. And the larger aim in this case is the Belt and Road Initiative. And this is really a plan for the economic and military domination of the Eurasian landmass. And so we're talking about 2/3 of the population of the world and 1/2 of the global a gross domestic product. Now, ironically, this is really the same plan that the Japanese had in the 1930s in their greater East Asian co-prosperity sphere. Now, what has changed? Well, after years of North Korean provocations, finally, President Trump has responded. And this has made the Chinese nervous because it has shifted North Korea from a distraction to a focal point. And in March, the Chinese summoned Kim Jong-un to Beijing and basically read him the Riot Act. And a month later, we have this love fest going on between the leadership of North and South Korea. So, you know, that's where we are. We're heading into the, you know, the opening ploys in terms of a negotiation.
Yeah. You had an interesting closing line in this piece in the Daily Caller. You talked about the need to maintain high vigilance and low expectations. I thought that was really an elegant way to summarize what we'd best be doing here. You, of course, are talking about China as really the big problem. And while we are focused on the shiny dangling object of North Korea, perhaps we best be being very, very vigilant about China. One of the things that we've talked about from time to time, and I'd like you to spend a few minutes with us walking through the various elements of the Chinese strategy around this One Belt, One Road initiative, specifically in South Asia. Talk, if you would, Narendra Modi, the Prime Minister of India, was in Beijing this past week. What are the Chinese up to with the Indians at the same time that they, of course, have been maintaining for a long, long time their relationship with India's enemy, Pakistan? And what role does all of this have cast for Iran?
That's right, Frank. The Chinese are playing a much bigger game than simply working with individual countries. As I mentioned earlier, their main plan is the Belt and Road Initiative, which is used to link all of Eurasia basically to the Chinese economy, and then the military dimensions of that. Now, one of the key elements of the Belt and Road Initiative has been with Pakistan, called the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. However, as you know, Pakistan has problems with, you know, Islamic terrorism and its conflict with India. So really, China is trying to play everybody in the region. They're meeting with the Indians and trying to develop a relationship with them. They've actually been very active in trying to produce reconciliation between the Iranians and the Pakistanis. They're negotiating with the Afghans in terms of their mining rights there. So they're playing a much, much bigger game, you know, as we, you know, tinker with counterterrorism and nation building in Afghanistan. I think we're missing the bigger picture.
Yeah. If you were to counsel President Trump or his new national security team, what would you be counseling in terms of, well, Afghanistan for starters, but more broadly, responding to this Chinese gambit, and especially in light of what I think we have been encouraged to believe was our opportunity to play the India card, if I can call it that, against the Chinese, having a fellow democracy that we could reliably work with to help contain Chinese ambitions in that part of the world. Your thoughts?
Oh, well, I think the Trump administration has already started to get it right. They're shifting from a focus entirely on the war on terrorism to focusing on both China and Russia. I think what we want to do is basically not let China succeed in its attempt to dominate the Eurasian landmass. So that means in exploiting the fissures, the geopolitical fissures that exist in the region, to thwart, for example, the China-Pakistan economic or any other links it wants to make in either economic or military, because they're building bases in the Indian Ocean. I think there are various types of things like ethnic separatism, leveraging the Shia-Sunni split, as you pointed out, working, for example, perhaps with India more. So there are a lot of different options to exploit the different geopolitical fissures in the region to prevent China from gaining domination.
Well, I guess what I was saying about India is if the Chinese are now looking to either neutralize that India card or put it in their own deck to be part of its play against us, or certainly part of the play in terms of dominating that landmass, do we still have that option, would you say? Or is this visit by Modi simply one that is evidence of his efforts to maintain through diplomacy a bit of a mix of responses to the threat that I think clearly the Indians feel is emanating and directed at them in part from China?
It is a diplomatic effort, but I think it's a bridge too far. I think there's a history behind the China-India conflict and the Chinese very tight relationship with Pakistan I think that is something that there will be great difficulty for the Chinese to succeed, and it's probably not to the benefit of India, because they don't want to become a client state to China, as Pakistan is beginning to come, especially in terms of the debt trap that Pakistan is in now.
Yeah, and debt trap is as we've discussed in the past, Dr. Sullen, one of the techniques that the Chinese are using to turn this whole enterprise, this One Belt, One Road drill, into what seems to me to be very explicitly what you mentioned, the Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere, you know, a colonial operation through and through, and very much contrary to the interests of the countries involved. I did want to ask you, though, on one other thing you mentioned, and that is exploiting the fishers, whether they're religious or whether they're, you know, demographic. That requires something that a sort of status quo power like the United States has not generally been terribly inclined to, unless I'm missing something. I think the times require it, to be sure. I just wonder, do you think that we're sort of geostrategically disposed towards that kind of response to the challenges that we've just been discussing?
Well, that's exactly right, and that's the problem. I think we need to learn to manage instability and in some cases exploit instability, and it's happening now in Afghanistan. We're trying to create stability in a region that is swimming in instability. And, you know, that may not be the correct way to approach this as China begins to try to gain domination in South Asia and in the Indian Ocean. We should be exploiting certain forms of instability to prevent China from succeeding and gaining domination.
Yeah, it's a blocking action, I guess, is what you're talking about. The reports out of Afghanistan in terms of the security situation and the willingness of the, or preparedness, I should say, of the Afghan government and its armed forces to contend with the threats, the instability, among others, caused by the Taliban, backed by Pakistan and others, is a prognosis for a lot more instability there and a lot less of what we had been setting out to do. Just very quickly, do you have a formula for a more successful policy on the part of the United States towards Afghanistan?
Well, I think we have to stop doing what we're doing right now, because the situation is just getting worse. Just to give you an example of the increase in instability that's occurring in the region is that their Iranian-trained Shia, approximately 80,000, according to reports, now in Syria, but these Shia fighters are migrating back into Pakistan and Afghanistan. We can't win a war in Afghanistan when we're dealing with a landlocked country and our supplies to our troops are vulnerable.
Thank you so much, both for your service to our country, Colonel Dr. Lawrence Sullen, and for your contributions to our thinking on these issues. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon. Next up, we will speak with Diana West about what we have learned, or should have learned, from negotiations with tyrants, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. It's time for our weekly visit with Diana West, the extraordinary longtime syndicated columnist. You can follow her these days at dianawest.net and The Daily Caller. And of course, each week with us, Diana West, welcome back. Good to have you as always.
Yes, thank you. Great to be back.
So, Diana, I wanted to just sort of noodle around with you as a serious student of the business of political warfare, notably that you recounted brilliantly in American Betrayal. What do you make of what is going on at the moment in terms of what seems to me to be a fairly, well, no holds barred effort to destroy the president of the United States and do so with the instruments of his own government? What's afoot here as you see it?
I think you just described it. We are seeing the government itself, the departments literally of justice, the security agencies that are supposed to be keeping us safe, policing, our internal security, defending us from foreign enemies. We see all of these tools and very weighty structures, punitive structures, turned against the president, as we've been discussing now for a year and a half, and his various men of different degrees of intimacy and importance. We're seeing what should be called witch hunts in terms of looking for something that, according to all the evidence amassed, does not exist. That is what a witch hunt is. It's looking for something that is not there. We see the punitive actions against certain members of the president's circle. General Flynn, Michael Caputo is the most dramatic instance this week, describing how he lost his house in order to pay a lawyer to defend him against charges he completely denies. And what really struck me with the Caputo story that I've read about his testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee this week, he was asked about 20 people related to the Trump campaign about whether they had contacts with Russia, whether he knew they had contacts with Russia. It is very notable that he said no. He says that he said no in each instance, no, no contacts with Russia, no collusion with Russia, because when we look back to other investigations in our time, in our earlier times, we see Fifth Amendment taken frequently in these same kinds of investigations. They used to be called Fifth Amendment communists, people who would deny, or rather would not deny, contact with espionage circles, engagement in espionage, contact and involvement in the communist conspiracy. They would take the Fifth Amendment against self-incrimination. And here we see one witness in this case taking, apparently, making 20 negative affirmations that no, there was no collusion. That is a very big striking difference and shows really what we're looking at. We're looking at a punitive process that is part of what you and I have been talking about and others have been talking about in terms of a rolling type of coup designed either to paralyze or destroy the Trump presidency.
Yeah. Let me ask you, Diana, because this is now emerging in the Congress and in the larger political firmament as a question of Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, specifically playing a central role in so many pieces of this. The investigation was started, you know, at his direction, bringing in Robert Mueller to conduct, without evidence of a crime, actually, an investigation in pursuit of a crime. To the various ways in which he has been seemingly a witness or a prospective witness, certainly a very directly involved party to the sorts of things that you've just generically described as the government of the United States and its instruments being wielded against the president. There's an effort mounted, it appears, by members of the Freedom Caucus in the House to begin the process of his impeachment. He has lashed out at them in a speech yesterday at the Newseum. What are we to make of all of this?
It's a power play. The House Freedom Caucus is rather timidly moving in this direction, and I think that Rosenstein lashing out at them is his effort to outweigh their timid first efforts with this big bravado statement saying the Justice Department will not be extorted, which is an utterly ridiculous way to even greet this list of particulars that has not been officially placed against him. But we're all very familiar with these various either conflicts of interest and failure to carry out the law as he has sworn to uphold it.
No, and to the contrary, he's wrapping himself in the rule of law. It's sort of ironic.
It is, yeah. It's ironic, but it's theatrics.
Or deflection, as the case may be. And this is what we've seen an awful lot of throughout all of this, of course, when people have actually been colluding with the Russians to influence the election, notably the Clinton team and the Democratic National Committee. It's all, it seems, at the end of the day, deflection. Hey, Diana, while we're talking about American betrayal and some of your insights into all of this. Of course, we have in prospect now the President of the United States sitting down with Kim Jong-un, one of the most despicable human beings on the planet, I think it's fair to say. You had a conversation with an interesting chap by the name of Jeff Nyquist the other day. We have a new occasional paper by him coming out momentarily. I just wonder what the two of you concluded in terms of the advisability of sitting down with communists and negotiating with them, our experience as well as what may now be in prospect.
Yes, well, Jeff Nyquist is very astute in such matters, and I agree with him wholeheartedly in this. He put together a very interesting little discussion that sort of applies to each and every sit down with communists that's at my website right now. But the bottom line is you cannot negotiate with communists because they are not negotiating with the same set of factors that you enter the negotiations with. In other words, negotiations is just another stage of war. And consistently going back to the Russian Revolution and every single engagement by Western officials with first Bolsheviks, Soviets, moving on into various communists around the world, it is the way you lose. It is the way you are subverted. It is the way you are penetrated. And that's what our history shows us, whether we're penetrated on our own side and then meeting the enemy, which is usually the case. This has always led to disaster. And I see no reason to believe that what we're looking at is not just another instance of this long deception. And I'm disturbed by it, greatly alarmed, and do not predict great things out of it. It's more of the same. When Ronald Reagan, if I could just add, when Ronald Reagan came in, he actually had his government take a look at 25 years of arms control agreements with the Soviet Union. This had never been done to verify the observance of these agreements. And what they came back to him with is no observation of any of the agreements. And this is very much a lesson for anyone engaging in this kind of negotiation.
It's consistent violation of each of those agreements, I think is what you're saying. And I was there at the time, and I can tell you, we actually in the Defense Department were instructed to think about and begin operationalizing plans to violate these agreements ourselves, because otherwise, you're simply unilaterally disarming, and the other side, as you say, is not only waging war against you using diplomacy, but is winning the war. And Dinah, it reminds me the old adage about Soviet negotiating tactics: what's mine is mine, and what's yours is negotiable. And it's sort of the starting point for what generally doesn't work out very well. And I'm sorry to say that, and we don't have time to discuss this today, but we will in the future, I know. What we've learned about, well, I think of it as kind of communism with a god, this Sharia supremacism. The Iranians have obviously practiced this technique as well, the legitimization as well as the exploitation to our great detriment. And thank God for Bibi Netanyahu blowing the lid off of it. And shame, I have to say, shame on those who say, well, we knew he was lying, the Ayatollah. We were just going to get it better this time. And as you say, the history is not good for these fellows or their China, their communist counterparts. Dinah West, we have to leave it at that. So much more to talk about. We're looking forward to doing so with you next week. Come back to us then. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Afty. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.